Hello, this is Imogen Ragone at Body Learning. This interview is part of a series I'm conducting with different Alexander Technique teachers, maybe especially more experienced, successful teachers, to find out how they go about teaching a first lesson. I believe and hope this will be a valuable resource for the rest of us. So, today my guest is Tommy Thompson. Tommy is director of the Alexander Technique Training School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he's co-founder of both the Frank Pierce Jones Archives and the F. Matthias Alexander Archives, originally held at Tufts University. His 49 years of teaching experience in theater and the Alexander Technique includes appointments at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Tufts and Harvard universities, and over 400 Alexander workshops and seminars in 14 countries worldwide. He co-founded Alexander Technique International and was ATI's first chair. So, Tommy, that's great. Thank you, and welcome to the show. We've never really talked before. I'm hoping to meet you later in the year and you come and do workshops in my neck of the woods. But I'm very excited to learn more about your approach to a first lesson. So starting at the very beginning, when a prospective new student contacts you, whether that's by email or by phone, do you have a particular way of handling it, maybe specific questions you ask or information you want to give before you meet them?
Yes, I do. you know, it used to all be by phone.
Uh-huh.
Increasingly, it's less and less by phone and more by email.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, and then there's the occasional, or there even used to be more of this, the occasional you meet someone at a dinner party or something like that, and you strike up a conversation, and they either send somebody to you or they come over themselves. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's email now. And prior to email, when it was just the phone, I would simply talk to the person. I mean, I talked to everybody on the phone when they inquire. Some people have an idea of what they want to do right away. They want to come in and they want to study for a year. People want to come in try it out. But what I actually suggest to nearly everybody, and I've done this from the very beginning, is I ask them to come in and I ask them why they want to come. Mm-hmm. So I get a little background information. And if the background information is, the familiar back problems and things like mm-hmm. that, inevitably I will ask them whether they've been checked medically, mm-hmm. because you really do need to know. For the most part, my person's back problem is little more than a problem, and it's not organic, and it's not necessarily the back itself, but their use. And and we all know that. And so I do talk. I want to know whether or not that's the probable issue. And if they, I ask them, how long have you had a particular issue that you want me to address? And if it's a long-standing issue, you know, I do go into, have you been checked medically? And I go through a long list of things, and it's all conversation. And then I set an appointment, and I suggest that they set one appointment, and the reason for that is I do want to know, quite honestly, whether or not I feel as though I will be beneficial to them, mm-hmm. and I want to give them a chance to see whether or not I'm the right person for them. And so that's in one session. I sometimes tell the person, because they often ask, how long will I need to come? Uh-huh. And, you know, and I say, I don't know. let me see you once, and then we'll take it from there. Now, if I do give them a lesson, you know pretty much pretty soon whether or not you're going to be are going to be a benefit to them. You really do. And you do have an idea of how long it might take, but you never really know as well, because other things show up mm-hmm. during the process of study. So I tell them all of this, and I say, why don't we set 3 to 5 lessons, and you can cancel anytime you want. And 3 to 5 lessons gives you a chance to, if they want to continue after the one session, mm-hmm. and 3 to 5 lessons give them a chance to have some idea of how much they really want to commit to the work. Most often, a person experiences quite a bit of change right away. I find that to be the case most often. Occasionally, a person will come in and they won't experience everything right away, or their experiences are so foreign to them that they can't explain them in a way that makes sense to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the 3 to 5 lessons gives them a little bit more leeway, but it doesn't commit them to something beyond what they want to commit to. Now, in the UK, I want you to take 20 lessons or 10 lessons. That's a lot of money for them. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to spend the money on you, they should feel as though they know why they've chosen to stay. So that's the phone. And if it's email, it depends on the mail. If the mail looks like it deserves a conversation, I ask for a telephone appointment first, so I can talk to them. Because you know, you really can, you can tell a lot about a person's voice in terms of how they're using themselves. And the voice is a great revealer. And so sometimes I really want to hear the voice so that I have an idea of who really is coming in. And sometimes I do that because I figure that I'm going to need longer for that person than the normal person. And so I'd schedule a longer lesson. So I guess what I'm really saying is I pay a lot of attention to the initial conversations with the people when they're scheduling lessons. And I do talk to them quite a bit. And I explain the technique if they ask for the explanation. And I try to explain it practically. In other words, I'll say, you're talking to me on the phone right now. You're using yourself, because I'm introducing the concept of use. You're using yourself. And I explain what that really means. And in all probability, your head's probably cocked around the phone, and you know, et cetera. And that usually makes sense to them. So that's pretty much the generic way I go about it.
Oh, that's great. So my next question was actually going to be, how important do you think a first lesson is? And I think you've maybe touched on it a little bit already, but maybe you have something else you'd like to say about that?
Yeah, I love first lessons.
Uh-huh. Oh, good.
I absolutely love them, because you're not the first person they've seen. They usually have seen quite a few other people before they come to you. Mm-hmm. Not always, but generally. Because most people come with an issue, mm-hmm. some need to be addressed. And when they come in, they describe that. Now, I ask them, you know, refresh me, why are you here? And then they tell their story. And everybody's got a story. And sometimes the stories are quite surprising. Sometimes they're familiar and kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're extraordinary, truly extraordinary, truly, truly extraordinary. And so I find that the first lesson is giving me a chance to really meet a new person, you know, in my life. And if I can be of value to them, I want to. And so the first lesson is an introduction to the technique. And I... I'll come at this a couple of ways. Because it is you getting to know the person and them getting to know you, what they need to know is they need to feel completely safe. Mm-hmm. And they will reveal to you information proportional to the amount of safety they feel. For instance, I work a lot with people who've been, you know, sexually abused or emotionally abused, and always have. So you learn an incredible amount about just how sensitive you do have to be. And so, in asking them to tell me their story, I'm watching the way that they use themselves to tell the story. And they usually use themselves to tell the story pretty much the same way they use themselves to exacerbate the conditions that lead to what they have. But I'm just, I'm getting information. I don't make use of all the information in the first lesson. I try to find the simplest way possible to introduce it to them. But the first thing I'm introducing is a brand new concept, and that's the concept of use. You know, they've experienced a lot prior to me or you, and you're introducing the whole brand new concept of, you know, you're paying attention not just to what you do, but how you use yourself to do it. And so, and that's what we all do. And then, and so that's the generic part. And I, if they're a musician, I ask them to play. You know, I do ask the musicians or anybody that's come for very specific reasons as an artist, I ask them to bring the material that they work with. If it's a, it's a, if it's a guitar, they bring their guitar. I want to see how they're using themselves to play the guitar. If they're on the computer, I want to see how they use themselves to, you know, to work all day sitting in an office. So I try to get as practical as I can before I become nearly completely philosophical. So that I just can't help. But
so is it the, you know, when they first come in, that's when you're really having this discussion with them?
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
Then you go
then
on
I start
to
working with them. Then I start putting my hands on.
And that might be the activity that they've brought.
That's the activity, or sometimes I go, let's go straight to the table.
Okay, I just wondered if there were some standard things you always introduce or do in the first lesson.
I introduced the head neck reflexes. I mean, everybody calls it primary control, but I introduced the relationship of the head relative to the rest of the body and how it affects the totality. And I introduced that right off. But I also... there's an interesting thing you can do. I don't know how this will play without a person actually experiencing it, and I've only done it last month.
Okay.
But, well, it's you know, you put your hands on someone and they get used to your hands and they go, oh, you got magic hands. And I wish I had your hands always. And the point is, all you can really say is when you know when my hands aren't there, it's not really important that my hands aren't there. The hands just introduce you to a new experience, and they introduce you to a new body of knowledge that you can take away with you. But what you're taking away is an awareness. And so the hands guide you into a different level of awareness. So the other day, about a month or so ago, I had my hands on somebody, and I said, what I want you to understand is that I'm giving you a different level of awareness that you can take into your life through this experience that you get with my hands on you. So I promise you that when I take my hands away, I will only take my hands away, and I promise to leave you with your awareness.
Huh.
When you say that to a person and you take your hands off and you promise to leave them with the awareness, there's a really nice moment that happens. Because when they walk out with the awareness, not wondering where your hands are.
Huh. I like that. Yes.
It works very well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm doing that a lot now. And but the other thing about the first lesson is you can – a lot of people in the workshops ask me, you don't really talk the way you're talking to us to a first person, to a last person you're giving a first lesson to, you do. And I say, absolutely. I say nothing different. The people that come in probably are smarter than you are. You know, they are far more accomplished at many things than you are. They're savvy. It's just that they don't have they don't have the language, and the language that will fit in with the concept of use. They don't have the language for self-awareness and monitoring how they use themselves, given what they're doing while they're doing it. And so all they need is a language. So you just guide them into their language. But the thing that I always see when a person comes in for the first time is their story and their life, because you're putting your hands as much on their story as you are their body, because the body is reflecting the quality of their experience given the situations in their lives. For instance, sometimes I have no idea what to do in the first lesson. And so what I do is listen very carefully to them. But a woman called me, this was years ago, she says, I've adopted two little Indian girls, both from orphanages. And I don't know if you know how women and children, little girls are treated in India. I said, yes, I do. So we don't know what's happened to them, but one's 5 and one is 8. And the 8-year-old is now beginning to act out because she feels safe. And I'm wondering if I should bring her in to see you, and then you might be uncovering things and she might be very emotional. Or should I just wait until she's 30 and send her to a therapist? So I says, well, why don't you let her decide? I said, bring her in, and I will be, I'll be touching her. You know, I'll have my hands on her. And if she feels completely safe while you're there, I never work with a child without the parent there. Mm-hmm. And I said, if she feels completely safe, then let's work with her. If she doesn't, you send her to a therapist when she's 30. And so I get to the office, and it's about an hour and a half before they come. And the woman says, I have one more bit of information. My husband told me he was going to divorce me last night, and we're telling the children tonight.
Oh, gosh.
So my first lesson, right? The little girl comes in with her sister and her mother. The mother's very distraught. The little girl has no idea why she's there. Mm-hmm. So what do you do for a first lesson to an 8-year-old adopted Indian girl who Lord knows what has happened to her? What do you do? Well, first of all, I worked with the mother a little bit on the table so she could see what was going on. And then I had the little girl come on the table. So I'm working with her on the table, and I noticed the first thing she does is get really, really, really quiet. So I went, well, I will join her in that quietness. I will work silently and as deeply as I can. And after, I can't remember, 15, 20 minutes, I said, how do you feel? What do you feel? And she says, I feel a happiness inside.
Aww.
And I went, my first lesson. I said, that's great, because I didn't give it to you. I said, what I do with my hands is I take away what keeps you from preventing, what keeps you from feeling the happiness inside. And then I said, and sometimes somebody will say something to you that makes you feel that you don't have that happiness inside. But you remember, if that ever happens, that you always had that happiness inside because it was there before I got here. And so the woman calls me the next Monday and she says, well, it worked. You know, that night my husband, we told the girls, and that weekend, we cried, we yelled, we screamed, we did all the things that you would expect us to do. And I was putting my daughter to sleep that night, and I started crying. And my daughter looked at me and she said, "Well, you can cry if you want to, but I'm going to remember what that man said about my happiness always being inside." So that was my lesson. That was the first lesson.
Wow.
That's the first lesson, and I never saw her again.
Huh.
And every now and then, it's interesting because the story goes on and on and on. It 8 years later, there was a woman from Germany who wanted to come over and train, but she was trying to get a job over here so she could. And she went for an interview with a speech pathologist. And so she's sitting in front of the woman, and all of a sudden the woman, who was the mother of the little girl, nowhere starts telling her the same story I just told you. And the woman from Germany says, just a second, I'll finish the story. And she finished the story. So the mother came in that weekend, scheduled a lesson, just to tell me that everything was going okay. So a lesson can be anything.
Yeah, I think that's really, I mean, I've never had anything remotely like that. But it's good to know even one lesson, even if they don't come back, we can't know what that's.
You never know what the person experienced. You never know. If I can relay one more,
Sure.
This is the first lesson. 14-year-old boy comes in. I think I have this story in one of my articles on the website. But he comes in for a lesson, and he wants to play football, and his father wants him to play music. I forgot what he played. And the boy is tight, and he's big for his age, and he's angry, and he's got one of the stiffest necks I've put my hands on. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working with him, and he says, this is the first lesson. And I say, I believe that you can go deeply into a first lesson if the situation presents itself. Mm-hmm. And you do that if the person feels safe enough to speak who they are to you. And so he says, if I continue having lessons, will I continue to want to play football? I went, well, if your desire is to maim somebody, you might not want to play football because you will be less aggressive probably. I said, if your desire is the love of the sport, the movement of the sport, you'll just probably do it better and with more efficiency. He says, what if I want to kill? So I said, who? He said, the kid next door. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, every time I see him, I beat him up. I said, once isn't enough. And then he said, I'd never want to be like him. So I'm going, well, this is psychological, and this kid needs some help. So I said, where do I take this lesson? First of all, I don't know if he's coming back. And so I say, why don't we put this to the test? I said, when do you see the kid again? He said, I'll see him this weekend. I said, well, you know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to beat him up. Why don't you give him a break? Give him a break and work with yourself. And I gave him ways of working with himself. The moment you decide you want to go over and beat him up, just say no. No, I'm going to let my neck be free. And I gave him a variety of food. And just see what happens. And so he comes in for his next lesson the next week. He said it worked. I didn't beat him up. And that was enough for him to want to continue to study. So he studied all summer long. And he didn't go to football camp. He went to music camp. Turned out, graduated with honors from Columbia. And he showed up here when he was 30 to bring his fiance, who is Mexican, to have her experience what gave him the experience that he felt led him to her. Huh. And that's that long later.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, and you a first lesson can be anything. And so after I have sort of initiated the person into the whole concept of use and primary control and all of that, I then am very much aware that there's a person in front of me who has a story and who has a need that they want addressed, mm-hmm. and that they're perfectly capable of making their own sense of self-discovery. And I think it works. I think it mm-hmm. works. But I love first lessons because of this.
No, it sounds. So you obviously take an extremely responsive, is maybe the word that comes to me, approach to the first level, probably to any lesson. But is there anything you consciously or deliberately do not introduce in a first lesson, or is it no?
That's a good question. I don't use words like inhibition mm-hmm. and means whereby. I don't use all the Pat Alexander words. If I do use them, I use them to describe the lingo that belongs to the technique, mm-hmm. and then I explain why, because this is my feature. Frank Jones used mm-hmm. to say the same thing. I explain why these words are used. But for inhibition, I prefer withholding definition because I feel that most of all of humanity's issues are the inability to withhold definition. We define things very quickly. If I can use the Patriots win the Super Bowl, you've got I talked about this morning in the class at Harvard. Because one of the guys, the actors, is an ex-football player. So I said, you've got four downs to go. You've got them. They're yours. You're on the first one-yard line, and you make a choice to pass. I said, why on earth would you do that when you got four downs? And you risk losing the Super Bowl, which is what the guy did. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that we're so inclined to do, and we favor doing at the expense of being. And it's the being aspect of us where we have all of our support and we can see more clearly where we are in relationship to the totality of things. But we're so inclined to do that let's pass rather than see the reality of it. And so it's quickly defined. And what I ask the person to do is, I think in matters of identity, you have worlds of time. You know, if a car pulls out in front of you and you got to step out of the way quickly, you have to define things quickly. But for the most part, you have a lot of time when it comes to your identity, who you think you need to be at a given moment. And so I will give the Alexander words that Alexander himself used, but it's the 21st century, and I think we need different words.
Yeah, I agree.
So I use mine, mm-hmm. and withholding definition is what I use a lot now.
Okay, good. And,
Cool.
Well, my next question was more, you know, I think you said really you take the same approach, maybe I misheard, that you have done from the start with the first lesson, or have things evolved or changed over time and how you conduct a first lesson? I can't imagine they haven't evolved at all. But
they've evolved a lot. First when I first started, I had no idea what I was doing.
Like the rest of us.
So you learn a lot from you learn an incredible amount from working with people. Mm-hmm. And I think the major evolutionary steps is I'm trying to figure out how to do that. I've always been I did 18 years of theater. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I was used to working with actors. I was used to performing. I was used to audiences and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I had no problem with communicating to another person and guiding that person, because you would guide your actors into their own self-awareness of their own character. And you would, you direct a show, you would guide the entire cast into the same thing. And I would often not block the last three pages of a play. I would say, finish the play. You know it better than I do now. And then dress rehearsal, they would block the rest of the play. They would end the play. They would never end it. You know. So I'd do things like that. And not always. But, so I started teaching one-on-one. My first teaching really was group. I was doing group before one-on-one because I was using my own classes at Tufts. Uh-huh. and later at Harvard. I would be teaching a class on acting, and then you end up introducing the concepts of the work into a scene, and pretty soon you got your hands on the person doing the same thing. So it was in the context of the entire class. And then when they started doing private lessons, it was a whole other world. Mm-hmm. The private lessons are very much one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And so the evolution took place in that one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And I found I find myself in my own development as a teacher of the technique, coaching the person I use my hands a lot. I have my hands on the person a lot. But I work with a person in a lot of activities, not just, I do a lot of table work, sit to stand, you know, all that. But I try to find what the person's interests are and to do it. If they do yoga, I do your yoga. Let me work with you while you're doing your yoga. And it's the learning is how can I introduce something similar to a seed and let them grow in the awareness. It's very Socratic. Mm-hmm. Is that they, rather than me answering the things for them, guiding them into that moment where they can say what they've never said before about what it is they're doing and how they're using themselves to do it. And if they need a practical demonstration, the hands are always available to introduce them, to demonstrate that. So that's where it's evolved. It's turned into a lesson is turned into a coaching, guiding, always with the understanding that they have the capacity to catch on quickly. And it doesn't always happen, but it usually does. And then when they come back, and this is essential, I think, I don't see them the same way I saw them before. Presumably, some change has already happened. So I try to address the person who's gone through some degree of awareness changes just after the one lesson. And by the time they've had the 30th lesson, they're completely different on some level. And so you take them as they are, and with the understanding that they are already in the process of evolution.
So do you specifically give them what you might call homework or things to think about?
I do.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
The first thing I do is I say, don't do anything. You know, I want you to go out, and I simply want you to become more kinesthetically aware of what it is you are doing rather than what you think you're doing. But do not try and change anything. Mm-hmm. And my term for this is let yourself meet yourself being yourself. And then you decide if that's the self you choose to reinforce. But don't try to do the Alexander work. Don't try to avoid doing what you're doing habitually. Get to know what you do. Understand why you do it. Mm. And because it's not the body that's doing it. You know, your physical posture, your postural frame of reference is, you know, it's reflecting the quality of your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, etc. You go somewhere and you're thinking, that's what does it. And so that's where you want to find yourself. And so I suggest that they not try and make any changes at all for weeks and weeks and weeks. Mm. And then we move into making changes. If a person needs something practical, I'd say, okay, when you wake up in the morning, appoint 1.5 hour, 2 to 2:30, and you go, whatever happens in your life, you'll approach it from the standpoint of what we've been studying and do the best you can. Or if you have 3 difficult things that you do, every time you do them, approach it from the standpoint of the work. Or if you have 3 things that, or 1 thing that you really love doing, approach it from the standpoint of the work. It's not always negative, in other words. Mm-hmm. So that's when I get practical.
Do you, to get even more practical, do you ever give handouts or written information or write notes for them or for yourself?
I suggest books to read sometimes. Uh-huh. They often ask me. Mm-hmm. And I suggest, well, a number of books that you know, you, a specific book for a specific person, and or articles, and sometimes things that have nothing to do with technique. Uh-huh. Read a book on meditation. Read Zen and the Art of Archery. I stress the fact that it is a learning experience. Mm-hmm. You know, they are lessons, and they are sessions that we go through, but they are lessons learned. And I tend to focus more on remembering what you know rather than trying to learn something new. Because at some point in your life, you did have a better understanding of unity until you started to individuate and make choices that this is more important to me than that. But when you were a child, everything had kind of equal emphasis, and you were more available to taking in a lot of information. I have said in the past that a lesson should be more about a celebration of life than introducing the negative with regard to habitual patterns of behavior. You know, I often use the word familiar rather than habitual, because it is the familiar as opposed to the unfamiliar. And it is the potential of the person as opposed to right or wrong. And I emphasize a lot of potential from the very first lesson, the very first lesson on.
So this might connect with my next question, which was what might be some typical or potential mistakes that new teachers might make, or pitfalls, or any advice for new teachers that you might have.
Yeah, I'll say what I said once at the chef, and everybody looked at me and their mouths went agog. I was in Lausanne, and they said they asked me the same thing you just asked me, and I says, well, you don't need to teach the way you're trained.
Uh-huh.
And everybody went, what? I said, you trained in order to understand all these tools of awareness that we have. But you have a lot of information. You can't introduce all of it at one time to a person. You introduce a little bit, just enough. And that's where I made my mistakes early teaching. I would just go on. I had practically memorized everything Frank Jones did. I'd go off in these long diatribes, and I'd see them spacing up. So very quickly I learned that brevity is better. You introduce that which they can take and make sense of. Don't try and introduce everything you know. The one thing you have to introduce right away is the concept of use. Because that distinguishes us from everybody else. And keep it as practical as you can. Let the philosophy grow out of that which is practical.
Oh, I love that. That's very freeing, what you said about you don't need to teach the way you trained.
You really don't.
Yep.
If you do, you're training them. But you want to teach them. And to teach them, to teach for me, them, is to bring them to an awareness of what it is they're reinforcing that has nothing to do with who they might be. Mm-hmm. It's who they think they need to be them in that moment. And but that may have very little to do with who they actually are. Mm-hmm. So not trying to teach so much and listening to them. I think early teach, when you first begin to teach, listen. There's a beautiful book by an osteopath, Robert Fulford, who in his book that he wrote, his autobiography, he has a last chapter of the book is on the Elegantia technique. And it's called Touch of Life. And an osteopath contacted him once, because Robert Fulford had always, you know, full practice always. Contacted him. He says, what do I do to attract new patients? And we would say, what do I do to attract new students? Mm-hmm. And Fulford just said, love your patients. And love your students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was teaching once, I had this young guy in my training course, he was a prodigy. He was playing jazz guitar with Herbie Hancock when he was 15. His name is Julian Lard. She doesn't mind if I mention his name. And I mean, a real prodigy. And in fact, he's playing next week in Boston. And so he came in for a lesson and found me on the internet. And he was, I think he had taught at Berkeley when he was 13. And
wow.
I know. And so he had come back to Berkeley to study composition. So he comes in for his lesson. He starts talking to me about his mentor, Gary Burton, who had sort of discovered Julian when he was about 12 or so on TV. And just heard something about his 2 minutes of playing that he knew was brilliant. And so little did Julian know that Gary Burton, the vibraphonist, he had studied with me when Gary and I were both 36, and now I'm 72 now. So Julian is taking a lesson with his mentor's teacher. Mm-hmm. So when he found this out, he says, "Can I train?" I said, "Well, how are you going to train if you're going to Berkeley?" He said, "I'll do both." So he did both. Mm-hmm. So whenever Julian played in class, it was always beautiful. Mm-hmm. In class, they asked me once, said, "Tommy, what are you really doing with your hands? What are you really touching? Who are you touching? Who are you touching? What are you touching other than muscle tissue and connective tissue and all of that? What are you touching? Who are you touching?" And I go to myself, like, I don't have no idea. You ask me that kind of question. So I said, play something. So Julian starts to play. And I went, "Oh, my God, I know exactly what I'm touching." And it's what we all touch when we give lessons. We're touching their beauty. Mm. We're touching the beauty within them. And the beauty can be defined however you want to define it. I'm not talking about physical beauty. Sure. I'm talking about their commitment to their life. Mm-hmm. Their commitment to living their life as close to who they could be, can be, are, as they possibly can be. Mm. You know, you might say living their life close to their soul's purpose if you're into that. And that's what you're touching. And when I put my hands on him playing, I knew exactly what I was touching. So, and you say, so the little girl comes in and she's got that happiness inside. Uh-huh. You know what you're touching. And you're always touching something other than what you think you're touching.
That's interesting. That's great. So just before we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, yeah, I guess. I haven't never say this, but I like offering a little bit of advice to a younger teacher. I mean, right. I had no desire whatsoever to do what I'm doing right now. None that I was aware of. I was perfectly content and happy and successful at being a theater director, teaching universities and directing shows here and there. And I guess I won't go into all of that, but I when I did make the decision to explore teaching, when Frank Jones virtually asked me to, and I resigned from Tufts, I mean, I had no idea if anybody would show up. Mm-hmm. And so I went on unemployment. I was 33. 6 months, and I started teaching. And the people that I first started teaching would follow me from Tufts, you know, and then people from the outside started coming in. And it took about 6 months before I found directing jobs around the country. And I even started writing a novel at the same time. And so I was really trying to figure out what to do. And so I stayed in theater and for several years, continuing to direct. And I just kept adding a half day of Alexander teaching. Mm-hmm. Kept adding a half day. And I was offered 4 incredibly good university jobs at Harvard, Cornell, Penn State, and California Institute of the Arts. And I kept saying no. So I knew I wasn't going back into that profession. Mm-hmm. And then I kept adding the half days. And because I kept seeing people's lives change. I'm really speaking to new teachers is what I'm doing right now. Is I kept seeing lives change, really change. And then one day, this woman, I'm sort of going out on a limb describing this because I know people. Some people are going to go, oh, no. there are others that won't. So this woman told me what she was getting from the lesson. I said, you're actually getting all of that from our work together? And she said, yeah. So I asked every single person that was working with me, what are you getting really from this lesson? And then I get the testimonials that I'm getting are no different really than the testimonials that the rest of you get when a lesson really goes well and a life has changed. Mm-hmm. Or a life is offered to the person. The life that they want and are due is offered to them because they let go of all these habitual patterns of behavior that have little to do with who they are. And so I thought, I said, you know, Tommy, you can continue to do theater. You could go back and be a professor again, I guess. But what more could you ask for than to be available for the person as a guide when they ask you to be? And so I went to my room and I says, okay, you guys are the guide of the universe. I'm yours. You know, I give you a lifetime of service. Two conditions. I don't want to be poor. And I don't want any dark energy. I don't want any dark energy. I only want light. After a couple of weeks, I had a waiting list of 6 months. After a couple of months, I had a waiting list of 2 years. All my theater projects died out, lost $13,000. All of a sudden, I find myself teaching the technique completely.
Wow.
And I tell you, I could never, ever have made a better choice. I mean, I listened to my father-in-law when he retired from the Navy. He was a Navy admiral, and he was retiring from commander of the Washington Navy Yard. And he was looking out at all the young cadets and all that. And he says, I could not tell you how pleased I am to have decided to have a life in the Navy and, you know, be an admiral. Mm-hmm. It's a great life. And I could say the same thing, you know, is that training to teach the work, even though you may not teach it full-time, you know, you could be teaching in a university theater or whatever and then doing this as well. It's a wonderful life. It's a wonderful life because you learn so much from others who are learning. You really do. And you, yeah. So that's what I would pass on is that, I can't think of a better choice that I made. I've been doing it a long time.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to finish up our conversation. That's fabulous. This has been really fascinating. I think everyone will find it really interesting and valuable. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
So just my guest today has been Tommy Thompson. If you'd like to get in touch with Tommy or find out more about his practice, we'll put a link to his website next to the interview. And we'll also put a link to a site where you can find a teacher anywhere in the world. Thank you so much, Tommy, for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.